BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the cellist Sheku Kane Mason. At 24, he's one of classical music's brightest stars, with a CV many musicians twice his age would kill for. His appearance at the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle in 2018 catapulted him to international recognition, with an estimated global television audience of 2 billion. Since then, he's performed everywhere from Downing Street to the Hollywood Bowl and was a soloist at the last night of the Proms last year. He's the first cellist to hit the top 10 in the British album chart and had an MBE for outstanding achievement by the time he was 21. He began playing the cello when he was 6. By 9, he had completed all of his music grades, receiving the highest marks in the country. And at 17, he won the BBC Young Musician of the Year competition. He still remembers the first time he picked up the instrument that would change his life. He says, "I loved the feeling of almost hugging an instrument and feeling its vibrations, looking down at the fingerboard and seeing all the possibilities." Sheku Kane Mason, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We're absolutely thrilled that you're here, Sheku. So how would you describe your relationship with your cello today? I mean, I was surprised that your cello is with you.
It's not with me literally all the time, but a lot of the time. I have a rehearsal after this. That's why I brought it.
But it did feel right that you walked through the door carrying it, though. I've got to be honest.
It's nice to have it with me. It feels comforting. And I spend a lot of time playing the cello and carrying the cello and being with it. And it's... yeah, in a way, it has taken me to so many places and to do so many things with that instrument. So I'm grateful for the cello itself.
You've described performing as a wonderful but draining sharing process. What did you mean by that exactly?
Oh, yeah, I mean, not draining in a negative sense. I don't think I could ever get tired of it, but it requires so much energy and concentration. And it's very, very demanding in that sense. The responsibility of trying to present this music as truly and vividly and honestly as possible is one that therefore takes a lot of focus, but it's really wonderful. And I like the idea of a live performance, because you are there with this piece that's written, I don't know, a few hundred years ago, but it's been presented in this moment to this group of people with this orchestra or this chamber group in this hall at this time. I love the centering energy of that, and it feels like that's really such a special thing.
For someone for whom music has been such a central part of their lives, how on earth did you go about choosing your discs for this programme?
I think it's a combination of things that bring about very, very strong memories. Some things that I find really, give me a feeling of excitement or exploring something, or something that's like I look at with wonder. And I think keeping those things with me as well, this sense of exploring and looking upwards and around and inwards.
Well, a sense of exploration and wonder is a great place to start. So let's go. Tell us about your first disc. What have you chosen and why?
Jacqueline Dupre's recording of Elgar's Cello Concerto. I was, so inspired by what I heard and saw of her. There's a wonderful video of her playing the Elgar Concerto, and I used to watch that a lot growing up and just try and figure out what was going on. But I think it's a piece that is so fragile at times and so constantly changing and constantly expressing, I guess, and the intention behind how she plays with this level of intensity and honesty has had a massive impact on me.
Thank you. part of the first movement from Elgar's Cello Concerto, performed by Jacqueline Desprez with the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir John Barbarolli. Sheku Kane Mason, you were born in 1999. Your dad, Stuart, is a senior executive for a luxury travel company, and your mum, Caddy, is a former university lecturer. You grew up in Nottingham, you're the third of seven children, and all of you play musical instruments to an exceptionally high standard. If I was to pay a visit to the family home when you were a kid, what would I have seen and heard?
A lot of practising all the time. Well, in the evenings, once we came back from school, we'd all practice, often at the same time, so it would be quite a cacophony of noise, sometimes nice-sounding music. But I think practice is a lot of repeating the same thing, so it wouldn't be so pleasant. to be listening, I'm listening to you necessarily, but I found growing up in that environment where you're surrounded by everyone else practicing, it meant that practice was less of a lonely thing because everyone else was doing it around me. And so, though I was in the room on my own working things out by myself, it felt like a thing that was quite collective. And then, outside of that, when we were interacting as siblings, it was chaos in terms of conversations and shouting over each other. And it works because that's how we've done it.
Was there a sense of competition between the seven of you? You know, all interested in music, all motivated to do well and achieve?
I think within music, there was never the sense of competition. I think in almost everything else, like how tall we were going to grow, or who's going to win this game of that, or who's going to finish their food first so you can get the first, second helpings, or who's going to have the biggest piece of chicken. All those kinds of things, there was always constant competition.
But not music?
But not with music, no. I think we inspired each other and helped each other and learnt together in lots of ways.
And day to day, your mum was looking after you guys the most because your dad worked quite long hours and was away early morning until evening. So she was flying solo with all you kids. She must have been very organised and quite disciplined to manage all of you.
Yeah, quite amazing. I think both my parents, to be very honest, are certainly some of the hardest working people I've ever met, and to have been around that from a young age. I think that's why my, although my motivation for practice, you know, fluctuates a little bit, I think this sense of practice and work being important was shown to us all by my parents constantly, because they were always working as hard as possible and had this genuine love and commitment to all of us.
So you were taught that by example. Did it ever bring a bit of pressure, though? I mean, it can be a lot, the expectation, especially when you're doing well, because, you know, as you've heard, you spun through all those grades in 3 years, I think, from picking up a cello to, you know, finishing your grade 8 with the highest marks in the country. That's a lot of expectation must have been whipped up around you.
Yeah, I think expectation is not necessarily a bad or good thing. I think it can be a very, very, very good thing. I think pressure maybe is a different thing. And I didn't feel the sense of pressure because I always felt very supported in everything that I did. And if I was struggling with something, the chance to ask for help was always there.
All right. Well, I think on that note, we'd better have some more music. Your second disc, if you would, Sheku. What's it going to be?
Rivers of Babylon by The Melodians. We used to have this CD that my dad had like written in like pen on it, like old Jamaica songs or something, I think. And all of the tracks were listed as just like track 01, track 02, track 03, track 04. And this was, I can't remember, like track 03. But we knew the name of this song. Some of the songs we didn't know the names of necessarily. And the sense of play with a lot of that music was also such a big part of how we listened and how we talked about it. Being open and listening. We do a lot of listening to music and dancing as a family, or listening in the car or things like that. And that's how I just came to know a lot of the music that I grew up with.
By the rivers of Babylon, where he sat down, and there he went, when he remembers Zion.
The Melodians and Rivers of Babylon. So, Sheku Kane Mason, you started learning piano when you were 5, following in the footsteps of your big sister, Aisata, and then took up the violin. Now, those instruments didn't take. Why not?
Yeah, I think, well, I was having lessons with my mum at the very beginning of learning the violin, and I think I wasn't so in it, and so those lessons I think were difficult for both of us, but particularly for my mum.
So when did you realise that the cello was what you wanted to do? It was seeing someone else play.
Yeah, I think I have a memory of seeing a youth orchestra, Nottingham Youth Orchestra, when I was about 6 years old. Seeing the cello section really, really appealed. And then I asked my parents if it was possible to learn the cello.
And what was it about the instrument that you were excited by?
I think at that age, I'm not sure. I think playing the violin, probably seeing something that had a richer range of sounds and being able to sit down and embrace the cello seems much more natural and enjoyable.
You had a lot of support at primary school, I know, in learning music, and secondary school too. What did both schools do to nurture and support your talent?
Both our primary school and secondary school had like concerts at the end of term where people would play. And I remember in my primary school, everyone from year four upwards would learn either trumpet, trombone or clarinet. There were lots of bands and music nights. We'd walk into assembly every morning and the head teacher would be playing on the, I guess, CD player or whatever it was. Yo-Yo Ma's Bach suites, for example, and Dvorak New World Symphony. I remember hearing that a lot.
I know that now you're a big advocate for music education. You visit schools, perform to kids. What do you get out of those visits?
I love those visits. I was just in the US and went to a school in Philadelphia where they have just started a program of everyone learning a string instrument, and it was incredibly moving to see a room full of children learning an instrument for the first time and sort of developing their relationship and talking to them about it and then playing to them and seeing from their questions and from their reactions what they were listening to and responding to. And what I love about it is, yeah, the feeling of confidence and having each child having something that they can do themselves and work out and explore and listen and have this feeling of endless creativity and exploration, but also the discipline and the focus that is required to learn an instrument, I think is incredibly important and centering and humbling.
Budgets are being cut and music education doesn't necessarily feel like a priority today. How do you feel about that?
I'm devastated. It's really a massive disservice to our children in this country if we're not giving them access to quality music education. You therefore create a massive divide of people who have access to this and who don't, and that's, I think, very, very, very unfair, and that's why I think it's such a shame.
And you've expressed your gratitude to the school that supported you when you were a kid. You know, you've put on concerts. Yeah. Do you know what they get to do with the money that you've raised?
For a while, I funded some cello lessons for students there for a few years, and various things. I've been back to perform and to talk to the children, hopefully as an inspiration. And I know in the music department there's lots of stuff about myself and my family. It's a bit odd going back to the school and having that there, to be honest. But it's also
like going to your nan's house with embarrassing photos.
It's a little bit like that. But no, it's really wonderful, and I'm so grateful to how supportive they were of me and my family.
All right, Shaker, we've been talking about music enough. Let's hear some more. Disc number three. What have you got for us today?
A song called That by Pluto Shervington. Again, one I listened to a lot as a child. My dad has the record, and so he'd play that often. For a while, I think either the record player was broken or the record was scratched. And it used to, you know, it does the thing where it like keeps repeating the same few seconds many, many, many times. So now when I listen to that song, I always expect like a few of the bits. But it's a great song.
So I follow the market, I sight the butcher boy by the gate.
You want wood?
No, I might a kill a queen.
Try beef now.
I no check to no grass where green.
What about fall?
What you know is time for a change.
Me and fish.
Got children out of that range.
Oh, what is steak?
What you know, you no sight the rate.
Try the tribe now.
Pull me belly when I pull me pipe.
All right, hold the pole.
Push your mouth by me brethren here. Sell I a pound of that thing there.
Pluto Shervington and Dat. Shaku Kane Mason, when you were 8, you won a scholarship to join the Primary Academy of the Royal Academy of Music in London and had lessons there every Saturday. Now, classical music is an extremely expensive pursuit, and your mum has said that every penny she had went on music lessons, travel, instruments. She never bought new clothes, wouldn't put the heating on during the day, never changed the car. Were you aware of the sacrifices that your parents were making, not just for you, but for all of your siblings?
A lot of the amount of effort and sacrifice, I don't think I was necessarily aware of. But now, I think the level of commitment and love that my parents showed to us, I think, is remarkable.
As much as your parents were compassionate and supportive, they were quite strict about certain things, I think. Mm-hmm. They restricted your access to TV as a kid and to the family computer as well. Did you ever resent that, try to get around it?
Certainly tried to get around it. Actually, yeah. With the laptop, it was only allowed to be used for homework. And when it was, my mum would have to come in and or my dad would type the password for the laptop, and we weren't allowed to see what the password was, and then we'd come back in the room. Mm-hmm. And when my dad would do it, he would type really, really quickly, so he didn't actually mind. We could be in the room, and we still wouldn't be able to work it out. But my mum types incredibly slowly with like one finger, and so we set up a small camera above the above the laptop, and asked my mum to do the password, and so she came in, did the password, and then we watched the video back, and we could decipher very easily what it was. And so then for a while, we had access, you know, to the laptop in secret, things like that.
Did your parents ever find out about that?
I think that laptop story, for example, I think we told them many, many years later when that didn't...
when it was too late. I think there's some things,
some things we did get caught, but it was clear that my mum was always trying her best and always showing love. So to then disobey, that felt quite hard. And my dad was terrifying, I think, sometimes. I mean, all in a, you know... coming from a place of love and making sure that we understood why that wasn't allowed.
It's time for your next piece of music, Shaker. We've got to make room for disc number 4. What's it going to be?
This is Haydn's string quartet in C major, a performance from the London Haydn Quartet.
And why have you chosen it?
I think Haydn string quartets and chamber music in general played a massive and does play a massive part of my life. I love the feeling of being in a group with 3, 4, 5 or whatever voices talking very intimately. This piece, it's either a shock in terms of how much it arrests you, or it's this feeling of awe of how can something be so magical and so precious. Also the feeling of music that I think is like out of this world, in the sense of like going beyond, like, I don't know, the imagination of what I feel that I can like feel and touch and see. It goes like beyond that.
Part of the second movement of Haydn's String Quartet in C Major, Opus 20, Number 2, performed by the London Haydn Quartet. Shaker Kane-Mason, you and your brother and sisters got a lot of positive attention growing up, but you've also talked about experiencing racial prejudice. What form did it take and how did you deal with it?
Very often in the spaces that I was in within classical music, myself and my family were very often the only black people in those places, and that's, you know, most of the time was fine in the sense of, you know, I felt comfortable and all good. But yeah, there are certainly occasions where my being black meant that I wasn't necessarily taken seriously in some situations.
And also outside of
music, but that's normal.
So in terms of those situations where you said you weren't like taken seriously, what, not listened to, not kind of included?
And often it's as much as the looks from some people when you walk on.
So the subtler things.
I think it's most often the subtler things, but yeah, sometimes also much more obvious. But yeah,
are you talking from you know, people watching you perform, or people in the orchestras, or
not from musicians that I was with, or teachers generally? Yeah, okay. from audiences and things like that.
And what was your framework for understanding that? Because especially when it's subtext rather than something that somebody's actually saying, it's a really big thing to get your head around. Who did you talk to about it, and who helped you understand it?
My parents a lot, for sure. What gave me the strength in those situations is we would spend a lot of time as children watching documentaries of like real like black heroes succeeding and being challenged and overcoming those people like Muhammad Ali. I think they, yeah, were certainly a source of like inspiration and understanding of those situations.
And unfortunately, it is still something that you have to deal with. Someone recently posted a racist message on social media after a proms performance given by your sister Aisata. The family saw it. How did that affect you? And how do you deal with those comments today?
The isolated incidents in the moment are offensive and affect you, but that's something that one can deal with. But I think the long term effects, I think, can be something that you're less aware of and more difficult to deal with. How you view yourself and how you are valued and your confidence and how you feel that you fit into the world. I think that's where, for me at least, and for a lot of people, I think
where are you at with that? What's your perspective on that?
It's something that I have to think about and examine very often. I live in a house with my brother and a friend who's a mixed-race classical guitarist from Brazil. And the three of us, we talk about this a lot, and I'm grateful for the conversations that we have because, yeah, you need the support of people like that because it's hard to navigate yourself, I think.
It's time for your next track, Sheku. What are you going to take with you to the island next?
It's a song by Bob Marley called Chances Are. Certainly one of my favourite songs and one that I listen to quite frequently. I find it is very accepting and hopeful.
Sorry for the victim now, though my days are filled with sorrow. I see years of bright tomorrow.
Bob Marley and Chances Are. Sheku Kanamason, in 2016 you won the BBC Young Musician of the Year competition. This was your third go. It's held every other year, so that's quite a long-held dream for one who was so young. What did it mean to you to finally win it?
Yeah, it was a wonderful experience and opportunity to, particularly in the final, for example, to perform for a big audience on television with a professional orchestra. Mm-hmm. The experience of playing a concerto. Yeah, wonderful feeling.
There was a lot of commentary in the media after you won because you were the first black musician to win the competition. What did that first mean to you?
Yeah, I was very proud of that achievement. And I think what it means to me is hopefully to inspire other young black children to see the cello and classical music as something that they can go on to do by seeing me. Yeah, that would be wonderful.
And there was a lot of celebration at home in Nottingham. I know the council were absolutely delighted to see you win and actually did something to commemorate the victory. That was quite extraordinary.
Yeah,
what was
it? They named a bus, like a public bus after me. And so I had like a picture of me on the back and then on the front, like my name. The thing is, it was the bus route that I would take to school. And so that was like a little bit embarrassing.
So you had to get on your own bus.
And I sort of
So it's a giant picture of your face on the back of the bus.
Yeah, and it wasn't like every... So it was like the bus route, so it would be like every like 7 or 8 buses, it would be me. But no, it's a massive honour, of course.
I mean, you know, we're joking, but there is a lot of responsibility that comes alongside that level of success. Is that ever uncomfortable or heavy to carry for you?
No, because I love music and do genuinely care about it. And so I'm glad of the less responsibility but opportunity to be able to share that with people. I think that's something that I really, really enjoy.
Speaking of which, it's time for your next disc. Number 6, what are we going to hear and why are you taking it to the island?
I'm taking Mozart's Requiem. It's one of those pieces that I find incredibly stirring and also very, very comforting.
Thank you.
the opening of Mozart's Requiem in D minor, performed by the Monteverdi Choir and the English Baroque Soloists, conducted by John Elliott Gardiner. Shekhu Kanemason, you played the wedding of Prince Harry and Meghan Markle, Windsor Castle, 2018. What do you remember about actually playing at the ceremony? I think they were signing the register and you did, was it three pieces you played?
Yeah, three pieces. I think at the time of performing, I was very much, I don't know, it felt like very much just playing to the people in the room. Of course, maybe somewhere I was aware of the fact that it's broadcast around the world. And
to billions,
like that,
but then also the people in the room, to be fair, Shekhu, I mean, we're talking David Beckham, we're talking the entire royal family. So.
Yes, for sure. For sure.
And many other luminaries.
I think in terms of like nervousness, I'm more nervous for my cello lesson because I know that my, you know, teacher listens in a certain way and a certain level of detail. So I guess what I'm saying is the audience. Yeah, for me, I'm grateful for them being there, but I don't think who is there necessarily puts something more, you know, as a more pressure event. But I suppose, yeah, I'm still a very shy person by nature. And that will always be there.
And last year, you performed at the last night of the Proms. What did it feel like playing such a prominent role in this well-loved, prestigious music festival?
Wonderful, wonderful feeling. And there's such a feeling of celebration, I find, at the Proms. I've performed many times at the festival. I think generally, the festival has such a feeling of celebration of music. And to be a part of that is wonderful. It's really fun.
It's obviously been a lot of conversation, certain amount of controversy around the rendition of Royal Britannia at the last night. What's your view on whether it should be included or not?
I don't think it should be included, and I didn't stay for that. That's just my opinion.
Why not?
I think maybe some people didn't realise how uncomfortable a song like that can make a lot of people feel, even if it makes them feel good. I think that's somehow a big misunderstanding about it.
What do you think it should be replaced with, if anything? What would you like to hear instead?
Oh, there's so much wonderful British music. I mean, like, the wealth of folk music from this country is astonishing. I think that would be a wonderful thing to take its place. I mean, yeah, there's so much that I think is worth celebrating and having as part of a big celebration at the end of a wonderful music festival.
It's time for disc number 7, Shekhu. What are we going to hear next and why?
Shostakovich's Symphony number 11. An unbelievable piece of music. I listened to it the first time, I think I was about 14 or 15, and listened in bed with my headphones and listened to the whole symphony at once and couldn't believe the journey that I'd been on listening to it. I think I've never seen it live, actually. I would love to hear it live, but I listen to this recording often. I think it's incredible.
Part of Shostakovich's Symphony No. 11, performed by the Moscow Philharmonic, conducted by Kirill Kondrashin. Shekhu Kanemason, you were diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when you were 12. How did you manage the diagnosis at such a young age?
The diagnosis came as a shock, and all that comes with that thereafter was all very new and a lot to deal with. And then at that age, you're growing and changing. And so a lot of the management of the diabetes is, I think, more challenging at that time because what you have to do has to be different each day. As you get older and it becomes a bit more stable, it's and also much more used to it, then it's easier. But it's something that I constantly have to think about and manage. And performing with it can be a challenge because it would be a massive shame if my blood sugar were to go low into a hypo as I was playing.
So do you have to be very careful about that?
I have to be very careful about that and make sure that my blood sugar is at a good level before I go on stage, because the adrenaline and the physicality and the focus of it can kind of
can cause it to dip.
And so I have to be aware of, you know, of that and make sure that throughout the day I've, you know, been managing it well. And but it's a thing that I have and accept that I have and will always.
You've already achieved so much at just 24. I wonder what your mindset is like these days, having had to develop such discipline and having achieved so many goals. Is that how you think now? Do you still have more that you're striving for, or are you in a different place?
There are like some very immediate things in terms of, I mean, I'm always learning new pieces of music, and that keeps me constantly, yeah, striving for...
You'll never get to the end of all that.
Impossible. And as well with the pieces of music that I already... know to some level there's a constant development with that as well, and yeah, there are many projects that I would like to do and to do more with. There's a youth orchestra in Antigua and Barbuda, where my grandparents are from, was set up 6 years ago, that I set up with my family and the government there, and I would love for there to be a concert hall on the island, and for that to become one of the centres of classical music in the world. That's like a ambition of mine that I would like to see.
Sheku, the last few years have been difficult for classical music and classical musicians. Obviously the pandemic, cuts to opera companies and orchestras, audiences that are ageing as well. How worried do you feel about the future of classical music?
The future of classical music is something that one needs to fight for and talk about and hopefully sort of be a part of. But I think the young musicians that I see all the time fill me with a lot of confidence in the future of classical music, but it will require a lot of work in many different areas. But I'm certainly confident in its future, however it will look like.
And obviously we're about to cast you away to the island. What will you miss most, do you think?
Family, friends, just people to interact and share with. If I think about most of the experiences in my life that I've really, really, really enjoyed, it will take me a while to think of ones that happened on my own.
Well, Sheku, we've got your company for one more disc before we cast you away. So what are we going to hear? What's your last choice today?
This is the Lager from one of Bach's organ sonatas. It's played by the pianist Samuel Feinberg, and it's magical.
Bach's Organ Sonata No. 5 in C Major, played on the piano by Samuel Feinberg. So, Sheku Kanamason, I'm going to send you away to the island now. I'm giving you the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you can take one other book. What will that be?
Richard Feynman, The Lectures on Physics, which I've not read before. So, yeah, I think I would learn a lot.
Well, that'll sharpen up your scientific perspective on the island.
Yeah, exactly.
That's yours. You can also have a luxury item. What's that going to be?
Cello certainly would be that. I'm not sure how it's going to survive on an island, though. Like, if I break a string,
I'm going to have to give you some. I think I can throw in a few spare strings.
Yeah, I mean, and some hairs for the bow. Maybe.
Okay, so some horse hairs,
case,
and strings.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
And finally, which one track of the eight that you shared with us today would you save from the waves?
I would go for Mozart's Requiem. Having something with voices can communicate something that's really, really, really powerful, and I think that piece has so much in it, so much like wonder and awe, and it's, yeah, I would say Mozart's Requiem. but I would probably change my mind as soon as I leave this this room.
You would get save that one and then wade back
yeah,
in to get the
exactly,
others.
Dive into the. Actually, I'm not a very good swimmer. That's
oh no! So no escape plan
so
for you.
So there's really no escape.
So you'll be all right. You've got your cello. Shaker Cannon Mason, thank you very much for lending us here your Desert Island Discs.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Hello, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Shaku. I'm sure his cello will bring him much happiness and comfort on the island. We've cast away many musicians, including one of Shaku's heroines, Jacqueline Dupre, and Yo-Yo Ma, and the pianists Stephen Huff and Mitsuko Uchida. You can find these episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Emma Hart, the assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paula McGinley. The series editor is John Gowdy. Next time, my guest will be the actor Jamie Dornan. I do hope you'll join us.
I'm Tom Heap.
And I'm Helen Chersky.
A journalist.
And a physicist.
Ready to tackle the biggest issues on the planet.
We've had a toxic relationship with nature for too long. It's time to reset and rekindle our love for the planet.
Each week on Rare Earth, a podcast from BBC Radio 4, we investigate a major story about our environment and wildlife. We delve into the history, how on earth did we get here? And we search for effective solutions to rising temperatures and collapsing wildlife.
But this won't be a weekly dose of doom-laden predictions. We're here to celebrate the wonder of the natural world and meet the brave and clever people with fresh ideas to bring it back from the brink.
Listen to Rare Earth on BBC Sounds.